Chapter 34, A Queen's Girl. The next 3 weeks were busy ones at Green Gables, for Anne was getting ready to go to Queen's, and there was much sewing to be done, and many things to be talked over and to be arranged. Anne's outfit was ample and it was pretty, for Matthew saw to that, and Marilla for once made no objections whatever to anything he purchased or suggested. More, one evening, she went up to the east gable with her arms full of a delicate, pale green material. "Anne, here's something for a nice, light dress for you. I don't suppose you really need it. You've plenty of pretty waists. But I thought maybe you'd like something really dressy to wear if you were ever asked out of anywhere of an evening in town, to a party or anything like that. I hear that Jane and Ruby and Josie have got evening dresses, as they call them, and I don't mean for you to be behind them. I got Mrs. Allen to help me pick it in town last week, and we'll get Emily Giles to make it for you. Emily has got taste, and her fits are not to be equalled." "Oh, Marilla, it's just lovely," said Anne. "Thank you so much. I don't believe you ought to be so kind to me. It's making it harder every day for me to go away." The green dress was made up with as many tucks and frills and shirrings as Emily's taste permitted. Anne put it on one evening for Matthew and for Marilla's benefit and recited the maiden's vow for them in the kitchen. As Marilla watched the bright, animated face and the grateful motions, her thoughts went back to the evening Anne had arrived at Green Gables, and memory recalled a vivid picture of the odd, frightened child in her preposterous yellowish-brown wincey dress, the heartbreak looking out of her tearful eyes. Something in the memory brought tears to Marilla's own eyes. "I declare my recitation has made you cry, Marilla," said Anne, gaily stooping over Marilla's chair to drop a butterfly kiss on that lady's cheek. "Now I call that a positive triumph." "No, I wasn't crying over your piece," said Marilla, who would have scorned to be betrayed into such weakness by any poetry stuff. "I just couldn't help thinking of the little girl you used to be, Anne, and I was wishing you could have stayed a little girl, even with all your queer ways. You've grown up now and you're going away, and you look so tall and so stylish and so different altogether in that dress, as if you didn't belong in Avonlea at all, and I just got lonesome thinking it all over." "Marilla!" Anne sat on Marilla's gingham lap, took Marilla's lined face between her hands, and looked gravely and tenderly into Marilla's eyes. "I'm not a bit changed, not really. I'm only just pruned down and branched out. The real me, back here, is just the same. It won't make a bit of difference where I go or how much I change outwardly. At heart, I shall always be your little Anne, who will love you and Matthew and dear Green Gables more and better every day of her life." Anne laid her young, fresh cheek against Marilla's faded one and reached out a hand to pat Matthew's shoulder. Marilla would have given much then to have possessed Anne's power of putting her feelings into words, but nature and habit had willed it otherwise, and she could only put her arms close about her girl and hold her tenderly to her heart, wishing she need never let her go. Matthew, with a suspicious moisture in his eyes, got up and went out of doors. Under the stars of the blue summer night, he walked agitatedly across the yard to the gate under the poplars. "Well now, I guess she ain't much been spoiled," he muttered proudly. "I guess my putting in my oar occasional never did much harm after all. She's smart and she's pretty and she's loving too, which is better than all the rest. She's been a blessing to us. And there never was a luckier mistake than what Mrs. Spencer made, if it was luck. I don't believe in any such thing. It was providence, because the Almighty saw we needed her, I reckon." The day finally came when Anne must go to town. She and Matthew drove down one fine September morning, after a tearful parting with Diana, and an untearful, a practical one, on Marilla's side at least, with Marilla. But when Anne had gone, Diana dried her tears and went to a picnic at White Sands with some of her commodity cousins, where she contrived to enjoy herself tolerably well, while Marilla plunged fiercely into unnecessary work and kept at it all day long with the bitterest kind of heartache the ache that burns and that gnaws and that cannot wash itself away in ready tears. But that night, when Marilla went to bed, acutely and miserably conscious that the little gable room at the end of the hall was untenanted by any vivid young life and unstirred by any soft breathing, she buried her face in her pillow and wept for her girl in a passion of sobs that appalled her when she grew calm enough to reflect how very wicked it must be to take on so about a sinful fellow creature. Anne and the rest of the Avalonia scholars reached town just in time to hurry off to the academy. That first day passed pleasantly enough in a whirl of excitement, meeting all the new students, learning to know the professors by sight and being assorted and organised into classes. Anne intended taking up the second year work, being advised to do so by Miss Stacy. Gilbert Blythe elected to do the same. This meant getting a first class teacher's licence in 1 year instead of two, if they were successful, but it also meant much more and harder work. Jane, Ruby, Josie, Charlie and Moody Spurgeon, not being troubled with the stirrings of ambition, were content to take up the second class work. Anne was conscious of a pang of loneliness when she found herself in a room with 50 other students, not one of whom she knew, except the tall, brown-haired boy across the room. And knowing her in the fashion she did not help her much as she reflected pessimistically. Yet she was undeniably glad they were in the same class. The old rivalry could still carry on, and Anne would hardly have known what to do if it had been lacking. "I wouldn't feel comfortable without it," she thought. "Gilbert looks awfully determined. I suppose he's making up his mind here and now to win the medal. What a splendid chin he has. I never noticed it before. I do wish Jane and Ruby had gone in for first class too. I suppose I won't feel so much like a cat in a strange garret when I get acquainted though. I wonder which of the girls here are going to be my friends. It's really an interesting speculation. Of course I promised Diana that no Queen's girl, no matter how much I like her, should ever be as dear to me as she is. But I've got lots of second best affections to bestow. I like the look of the girl with the brown eyes and the crimson waist. She looks vivid and red rosy. There's that pale, fair one gazing out the window. She has lovely hair and looks as if she knew a thing or two about dreams. I'd like to know them both. Know them well. Well enough to walk with my arms about their waist and call them nicknames. But just now, I don't know them and they don't know me and probably don't want to know me particularly. Oh, it's lonesome." It was lonesomer still when Anne found herself alone in her hall bedroom that night at twilight. She was not bored with the other girls, who all had relatives in town to take pity on them. Miss Josephine Barry would have liked to board her, but Beechwood was so far from the academy that it was out of the question. So Miss Barry hunted up a boarding house, assuring Matthew and Marilla that it was the very place for Anne. "The lady who keeps it is a reduced gentlewoman," explained Miss Barry. "Her husband was a British officer and she is very careful what sort of boarders she takes. Anne will not meet with any objectionable persons under her roof. The table is good, and the house is near the academy in a quiet neighbourhood." All this might be true,